Today on Against the Grain, particularly since the global financial crisis, capitalism's been seen as the culprit for so many of the world's woes, from inequality to the destruction of the environment. But no other system appears to be viable. But is that in fact the case? I'm Sasha Lilly. Journalist Richard Swift joins me to give his assessment of anarchism, state socialism, social democracy, and the left turn in Latin America. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Is there no alternative to capitalism, to paraphrase Margaret Thatcher? And is capitalism here to stay indefinitely? Those are widely held assumptions in our society, but, Richard Swift would argue, they're also misguided. Swift, who for over two decades was the editor of the New Internationalist magazine, has set about evaluating other forms of structuring the economy and society that aren't capitalist, weighing past history and current ideas. In SOS, Alternatives to Capitalism, he critically assesses the experience of the Soviet Union and China, the track record of social democratic states in Europe, Canada, and elsewhere, and looks at the so-called pink tide that swept Latin America. He also looks at anarchism, libertarian socialism, and the concept of degrowth advocated by some eco-socialists. He joins me by phone from Montreal. Richard, let's start with the basics. What's so wrong with capitalism anyway? Why are alternatives needed?
For one thing, it makes us incredibly insecure in our economic lives, and because of that, in our personal and psychological lives. You just look at the economic meltdowns that have occurred, the burst bubbles, whether it was the high-tech collapse or, more dramatically, the 2008 bank collapse, And this is the kind of speculative boom and bust that is buried deep in the soul of capitalism. I think another part of the elephant that you could look at is the level of inequality in the world today. I mean, it's pretty staggering, and one figure that is bandied around a lot these days is that the 300 wealthiest families in the world have the same amount of wealth as the 3 billion poorest people in the world. Now, even if that's an exaggeration, and it's only half that, it's pretty staggering. I think also on the ecological front, capitalism is addicted to growth for growth's sake, pretty much. And it's a kind of growth that we can no longer afford. Either in terms of the climate, or in terms of climate change, climate warming, or in terms of the poisoning with toxic chemicals of the land and the air and our food, in terms of the depletion of resources, in terms of turning renewable resources like, say, fish and soil into non-renewable resources, just because of the way we treat them and the amount of waste involved. So, you know, I mean, I could go on at some length about this, but I think that might give some sense of where I'm coming from in terms of it.
Well, but then in terms of thinking of alternatives, of moving somehow beyond capitalism, often one hears that capitalism really has to stay, is here to stay, and needs to stay because in some basic way we are all hardwired for selfishness and acquisitiveness. What's your response to that argument?
I think we're complicated as people. I mean, I'm not some kind of wild-eyed optimist who believes that, you know, all people are basically wonderful and we just are these fetters of the current social arrangements we have are making us bad. I think we can be many things. We can be covetous and nasty and mean and selfish and all those things. And we can be decent and kind and gentle and caring and thoughtful. So both dimensions exist in our range of personal behaviors and developments of our personalities. I think the problem with capitalism is it's a system that builds on the bad ones rather than on the good ones. So it doesn't, you know, it basically says that we're here to engage in what's best for us as individuals and damn everybody else. And I think that's its weakness, because it doesn't, even though we have a range of possibilities as people, the capitalist ethos is one that plays on this. Well, it's the Ayn Rand thing. It's the rugged individualist. It's, you know, the person who can climb to the top and step on the fingers of the people climbing after them. And I think that we can no longer afford to do that for the reasons I talked about before, in terms of the environment, of growth, of a whole range of different things.
Do you subscribe to the perspective that many, many people feel like the system itself isn't working, but just don't feel like any alternative is viable?
I think that's true. I think what's happened is that people have retreated from public life, by and large. I mean, you can see that in the amount of people who bother to go out to vote anymore. The U.S. is particularly bad about that, because in presidential elections it's over 50% still, but in non-presidential elections it's frequently fallen below 50% of the people who are registered to vote. That doesn't include a lot of people who haven't even bothered to do that. So, you know, that I think is a good indicator that that, you know, why should we care? It's all the same, really. It doesn't matter who gets in. And I think you find the same thing in other countries. I mean, here in Canada, we have a slightly higher percentage of people who vote, but not much. In systems where they have proportional representation, where, you know, each vote counts when you're voting for a party, it doesn't matter whether you're in an overwhelmingly Republican district and you vote for the Democrats, then in a proportional system, that vote would still count in the overall counting. But you don't. But even in those societies, like which are most of the European societies, and a good many of the societies that have representative governments in the global South, you're getting people falling off. Because I think part of the problem is there's a professional political class, and people's sense is that they're very self-interested, and that they don't really have a range of different ideas that they present to the population or the voter. So I think that sort of sense of there not being an alternative is very pervasive. I think also the sheer sort of level of anti-government propaganda that's put out, I mean, there's lots of reasons to be anti-government for sure, but the very idea of government is very much disparaged by the political right. They're basically saying, well, you know, taxes are bad and we've got to downsize government as much as we possibly can, by which usually they mean that we have to stop social spending for people who are vulnerable, and whether it's for health care or welfare or a whole range of different things. So I think that those kinds of things also play into this pervasive notion that there are no alternatives, because the politicians don't actually present us with alternatives.
Sure. So in terms of alternatives to capitalism, the ones that come immediately to mind are those that come out of the socialist tradition. So let me start by asking you about the tradition that would be most prominent in people's minds, and that's communism or state socialism. In your book, Richard Swift, you talk about the tradition of state socialism, but you're not a fan. Why not?
Well, I'm pretty hard-nosed on the question, I guess. I mean, I think that that what happened with the left in the 19th century is it got sidetracked into a belief that once political power was taken by an elite, that elite could then bring about a new world. But what was lost in that process was a sense that some of the original radical thinkers who inspired communism, like Marx, for example, or the anarchist tradition, or William Morris, or wide range of different political thinkers with all kinds of points of view, they had this sense that really this had to come from below, and not just come from below to elect or put into power an elite who would then sort of provide the wherewithal to create a new system, but it actually had to come and be sustained it had to give power in the sort of new left sense. It had to give power to people, and there had to be an institutional framework that allowed that to happen. You saw bits and pieces of it in the socialist traditions. You saw it in Catalonia and Spain during the Spanish Civil War. You saw it in the very beginning of the Russian Revolution when Lenin was going on about all power to the Soviets, giving power directly to the workers. But these things didn't last very long because you had a centralized elite core of revolutionaries, and the workers were, you know, they were considered to be unreliable, I guess would be the term that was used. So increasingly, there was an imposed dictatorship, and from the tradition of that tradition of state communism, it's proved to be a disaster, and it hasn't even proved to be socialist anymore. It's now if you look at it, and you know, the argument's been made by Wittfogel and a bunch of other social thinkers that really this was a transition in these societies from being, China and Russia being the most predominant examples, from being agrarian societies into becoming, through this kind of state communism, a kind of capitalist society. And you know, arguably, China is the most successful capitalist society in the world because they don't have to worry about the niceties of the rights of trade unions or the free debates that need to take place. They just plow ahead and make money and exploit workers, and somewhat similar with the oligarchs in Russia and Eastern Europe. So this whole sort of notion that we could do this from the top down has proved to be a real disaster for the left, and people quite rightly are suspicious of the left as a consequence. And the left has been not forthright enough in terms of saying, this isn't what we want, this isn't what we mean, this was a tragedy, we need to rethink the whole name of the game.
Well, one of the things that proponents of these revolutions would argue is that at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, and in fact, as you point out, dating back even further to a revolution that was not socialist, but if one even looks at the French Revolution, there's a sort of tension that emerges because, of course, these revolutions take place in a context which is not unchallenged. Obviously, the old order isn't particularly happy about giving up power. And so this question is then raised, how to preserve the revolution without betraying democratic principles. Obviously, with the French Revolution, led to the guillotine, the Bolsheviks self-destructed as well as eliminating their former allies on the left and so on. Is this a real dilemma that revolutionary movements on the left have faced and would continue to face?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think it's a balancing act that it's always, in politics, it seems to me like there's always a balancing act, and you have to kind of, and there's a tendency to want to resolve tensions one way or the other, to jump towards repression or to jump towards capitulation. But often I think you need to ride the balance. You can't just sort of come down one way or the other. You have to have a creative tension in terms of how you work things through. I mean, this is not, it's a bit of an abstract kind of answer, but I think it does speak to the kinds of problems that that revolutionaries and people who wanted an alternative to capitalism actually have faced. I think one of the great strengths that has not been valued enough in most of these traditions is they haven't had enough faith in empowering people and sustaining that empowerment. They've rather sort of felt themselves under attack and circled the wagons. And once they start circling the wagons, then the people who they're making change for, well, and the people should be making it themselves, and sometimes to a fair degree they are, but the circling of the wagons means that they're already going into a defensive mode, and they become very much, whether it's in terms of military tactics or economic efficiencies or a whole range of different things, they become very much what they were originally fighting against.
Well, the threats that they perceive, are they not, in a sense, real ones that do need to be handled in some way? You cite the other extreme, the situation of Salvador Allende in Chile, who was a socialist elected through a democratic election, didn't come to power through revolution, but who was overthrown in a coup backed by the United States. Or one could even look at the Spanish Revolution, which was very bottom-up, but ended up not being able to perpetuate the revolution because power was never held on to.
Well, it's true. I mean, it's not an easy thing. And I think that in a way, the movements that have occurred have been very easily isolated because they've occurred in very, they've often occurred in very traditional societies that don't have a lot of clout in the international sphere. They've occurred in very narrow, with narrow sorts of support and not broad-based support. And so they've been, the people who want to be done with them have been able to take advantage of that. And the United States has certainly been a leader in that recently, in that process. I think it's quite interesting what's happening now in Latin America, though. I mean, not that everything there is advancing to become an alternative to capitalism, but there's a widespread discontent which involves many, many countries at this point of wanting to do things differently, of wanting to have a much broader level of participation, of wanting to have more justice in terms of equality, of wanting to rethink the relationship with the environment in the case of particularly of the indigenous influences in the Andean regions in Bolivia and Ecuador and places like that. And there you've got a number of different countries who all at the same time are, you know, with different speeds and different, you know, contradictions that they're dealing with. But they're all at the same time wanting significant changes. And I think one of the things that's happened is the United States has been, you know, which has traditionally manipulated things in Latin America from back in, you know, when there was invasions in the 1930s in Central America. They have been kind of preoccupied, the Pentagon and the State Department, with what's happening in the Middle East and Israel, Palestine, and in the oil regions. So I think it's given Latin America a bit of breathing space that normally these alternatives have not been allowed. And so I think that's quite a promising development.
Richard Swift is my guest. He's a journalist and activist, author of SOS, Alternatives to Capitalism. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. So one of the two prongs, I guess one would say, that one could see as legacies of the socialist tradition is state socialism, which we just talked about, and social democracy. I'd like to get your take on how you see these Latin American countries fitting into which paradigm. But before I get to that, can you give me your take on social democracy as a viable alternative to capitalism?
Well, I sort of think nobody believes in social democracy anymore, mostly not even people who call themselves social democrats. And they haven't even, quite a while now, have not been... I mean, originally social democracy came up as a kind of an alternative to capitalism. But now I think you know, with people like Tony Blair in the UK and a number of, you know, the current Hollande government in France, and they go run right down the line all through Europe, actually, and here in Canada with the New Democratic Party, which I know people in the States are often very enthusiastic about, but is increasingly given up any notion of social democratic ideals. So really, the center, what I don't really call them social democrats anymore. I call them the center left, and that's what I tried to do in the book. And I think what they've done is they've basically they bought into the game. I mean, the difference between the right and the left is in electoral is very, very narrow. I mean, it's all often played up by both sides as being, you know, radically different. But when they actually come into power, there isn't much difference. So the attempt by the center left, I think, is to you know, have some mildly more humanistic management of the capitalist system rather than actually imagine a world beyond capitalism. I think that's no longer part of their political imagination. I mean, you can find the odd voice here and there within, you know, the British Labour Party or in Scandinavia. More now, what you're finding, which are groupings that are breaking with this sort of kind of capitulated center-left, are groups in Southern Europe who are rebelling against the imposition of these really rigorous austerity regimes in places like Italy and Spain. And there's this Podemos party that's recently risen up in Spain, which is quite an interesting development. But they don't have really elaborated political programs, but they have really distinct principles that they don't bargain away. I mean, they want basic income for all. They want public control of investment. You know, these are basically core kinds of things which would change society significantly. But I think the social democratic center-left no longer believes in these things anymore.
And so where would you situate the countries of the Latin American left turn? And of course, you did say that they do vary, but of course, you know, it ranges from Brazil to the so-called Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela to what's been going on in Bolivia and elsewhere. Would you call these different systems social democratic, something else? How would you classify them?
Well, I think what they are, I mean, I do refer to them in the book as social democracy with backbone. But I think they're more than that, really. I think they are sort of, they've become political homes for a wide swath of the population. And I think that people who live in these political homes often don't necessarily agree with each other. But they've decided that these are places from which they can work to try and transform their societies into something fairer and more ecologically sound and where there is a much greater empowerment in a region where there has been very little empowerment in recent history anyway. So I think that they are that. But within them you'll get, you know, quite conservative people. I think the Brazilian, the main tendency these days in the Brazilian Workers' Party, which, you know, Lula was in, you know, was the led to power much more than a decade ago now. They have in many ways sort of capitulated, although within the Workers' Party there's still a lot of agitation and holding to account. So, but in other places like the Bolivarians, Chavez took the idea of moving beyond capitalism seriously. He was far from perfect and tended to be a little more autocratic and flamboyant than he perhaps was good for the Venezuelan revolution. But he, you know, he definitely wanted to move things beyond, and the same is true in Bolivia and Ecuador. And Argentina is a very interesting case, because in Argentina you had an economic collapse, and the current government rose out of that economic collapse in a very sort of contradictory way. But there is a very strong base which holds that government to account. I mean, there's a whole range of workplaces and factories that were kind of left by their by their owners and then taken over by the workers and are still being run by those workers. So there's a strong kind of impulse from below. And then the same is true in Chile, which has in some ways, quite a conservative, it's gone back and forth between the right and the left, but it has a conservative or more conservative social democratic kind of government. But they have a population that works hard to hold their feet to the fire. And I think one of the ways that happens in Latin America, they have the same distrust, I think, of politicians as we do. But, you know, the ones they support, once they get into power, they don't listen to that old story about, well, now you're in power, you got to give us space. They just say, you know, you've got to do these things, and we're going to make sure that you do. So in Bolivia, when the Morales government was trying to push through a road that indigenous people didn't like, then they got a lot of heat for it, and that road didn't go through, I don't believe, at this point anyways. So there's that sort of self-activity, I think, in Latin America. And in Southern Europe, too, I think there's a lot more self-activity than there has been in the past. So I think these are promising signs.
One political tendency which has been given new life, particularly since the disintegration of the Soviet Union, is anarchism. And it neither follows the state socialist road or the social democratic road. How do you assess anarchism's viability as an alternative to capitalism? And let me pair that by asking you, how do you see anarchism today as compared to the classical anarchist tradition?
Well, I think anarchism has proved fairly adaptable to change. I think anarchism in the old school anarchism was, you know, there was obviously the tradition of propaganda by the deed and throwing bombs and that kind of stuff. But there was also the tradition of anarcho-syndicalism, which was based in unions. I mean, the IWW in the States was a really interesting example of that, as was the CNT in Spain. These are organizations with hundreds of thousands of adherents at one point. So there was that kind of anarchist tradition. But I think what happened in the sort of recreation of a lot of that got buried under fascism and communism, you know, in the struggle between fascism and communism, the anarchists started to get tromped on, and because there were no state governments that were going to pitch in for them. But it kind of went through a rebirth in the 60s and had an influence on the new left. And I think now what anarchism has become is less of a sort of doctrine and more of a sensibility and a kind of an impulse which kind of informs a lot of people's thinking. So there's a left libertarian kind of tradition which it doesn't sort of have one kind of overall model of what society is going to be like, and it varies in terms of its attitudes towards political authority. Some parts of it saying all that must go, and other parts of it saying, well, you need to kind of create some notion of the self-government of society if it's going to be at all appealing to people, because a lot of people don't think of government as just something negative. They think of government as, you know, giving them their pension checks and helping them out when they're down, and so there's that sense of government that you know, more classical anarchism would have just said, well, this is just buying you off. Well, that's a bit too simple. So I think the new sort of anarchist impulse sensibility is more less sort of doctrinaire and more kind of it kind of infuses itself throughout different social movements. I mean, I think you can see it in the environmental movement, parts of the environmental movement quite strongly. I think you can see it in movements for worker self-management and community development. A lot of the sort of suspicions of some of the dominant forms of technology, I think that's been informed by anarchism. So it's become a kind of broader perspective than it was traditionally, which I think is frankly quite a good thing.
And as you point out in the book, the kind of libertarian tradition that you're talking about as predominantly anarchist also has communist or Marxist legacies as well, the legacy of Rosa Luxemburg being one, or Anton Panikuk as another. But you just touched on something which, of course, is a real bone of contention within the left historically and today, and that is the question of the state. Historically, anarchism has said, we need to abolish the state. Lenin set out to smash the state, although the state, in fact, got very much preserved and under the Bolshevik Revolution ultimately. Your book, Richard Swift, SOS Alternatives to Capitalism, isn't just a survey of different tendencies or different potential alternatives to capitalism within the left, but also is an assessment. And on the question of the state, you come down arguing that it's really not enough for us just to say the state must go away. Can you tell us a bit more why you just started on that?
I think that we need to rethink government. And I think that the centralized state, as we've now, as it has now evolved historically, I mean, the notion of occupation is interesting because, the state is supposed to represent society in some sense. But these days I see, and you can see this in what's happening recently in St. Louis.
In Ferguson.
The state tends these days to occupy society as an alien force, when the original idea of the state was that it would represent society in some way. So I think we really have to kind of re-embed the state in society. We need to have a much more decentralized notion of political authority. We can't just have state representatives and Congress representatives, and we need to have many, many more different types of representation, whether it's at an upper level maybe in the Fed, but also just in terms of our workplaces, in terms of our communities. Those communities have to have real power. So you have to kind of, I think, devolve power downwards to the society. And at the same time, there are elements of power that need to be devolved upwards, in a sense, that the world, the world now basically is often ruled by, it's ruled through nation states, and the nation states that have the most money and the most guns tend to get their way. So we need to have a more democratic kind of representation that rises above the level of the national state as well. So I think we have to rethink this whole nation notion of representation and where representation takes place. So I think there needs to be some way in which we kind of think about governance as something that's not separate from us, but something that we actually do, that we actually run our... Because the original Greek notion of democracy was self-rule, and I think that's the tradition we have to come back to. It's not simple or... it's going to take a lot of struggle and rethinking to get us back to that notion of self-rule, but I think that's the only way to go. So in that sense, I think anarchism, which sort of sees the state as strictly a hostile force, I think that is too simple, because I think the state is a terrain more than just an instrument. I mean, both the Leninists and the anarchists see the state as an instrument that it imposes negatively or positively. But I think it's more a terrain over which we struggle and fight. And to make that terrain more democratic and to embed it more in our societies, I think that's a way to create a rebirth of the notion of democracy. And also a thing that, going back to what we were talking about before, something that will kind of ameliorate some of this kind of... despair with public affairs that vast numbers of people feel.
Well, what's to keep the state, especially as you're talking about it being a many-layered thing, from ending up having a logic of its own to concentrate power, which of course is part of the anarchist critique, but we were speaking earlier about the conundrum for left-wing revolutions and how they've ended up either losing power or concentrating power so much that the revolution itself almost became pointless. And many people would say, well, that's because of the state. The state has its own logic. Do you think there's some way to circumvent that logic?
Well, I think it is true. The state does have its own logic, and the centralization of power certainly has its own logic. I think there has to be a way to circumvent it. I mean, one of the things I try and say in the book is that there are no guarantees. It used to be the left thought, well, you know, history's on our side. It was all kind of up, up, and away, and triumphalist, and it's embedded in the working class that we're going to achieve this wonderful communist utopia. Well, I don't believe that. I mean, I think we've got a certain amount of chance to create something that's going to basically, I mean, SOS in the book, I originally didn't put it on the cover, but my idea was that it was save our species, because I think that's the name of the game at this point. So I think really, you know, there's no guarantees for any of this stuff, but I think really if we don't find a way in which people can be empowered and their imaginations be released in some kind of creative way, and I think there's ways to do it which are, you know, that sounds kind of airy-fairy, but I think there's ways that are quite practical. For example, if we had if everyone had a basic income in the world, which is not that hard to imagine, at least mathematically. If you got rid of, you know, the huge amount of wasteful luxury production, you got rid of all the military expenditure, it would be easy to provide a basic income for people. You know, then they would have the spare time rather than being caught up in, you know, in working three jobs as they are in the precariat now, in the marginal kinds of jobs that we seem to be inheriting in industrial societies. There'd be some possibility for rethinking life and culture, and I think that's the kind of profound change that you're going to need. Now, is there a guarantee of it? No, absolutely not. I mean, maybe, what are our chances? 30%, 35%, maybe. Odds are long, perhaps. But I think that's the kind of way to go if there's any possibility.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'll return with Richard Swift, journalist and activist, after this music break.
As I walk through this wicked world, searching for of insanity, I ask myself, is all hope lost? Is the only pain hatred and misery? And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I want to know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about other routes other than capitalism, other ways that we might be able to structure our societies. Richard Swift is my guest. He joins me by phone from Montreal. For more than two decades, he was the editor of the New Internationalist magazine, and he's the author of SOS Alternatives to Capitalism, published by New Internationalist Publications. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. So, in your assessment of potential alternatives to capitalism, you decidedly come down on the side of a kind of red-green combination of eco-socialism, which one can see roots of in the 19th century with the anarchist writer-geographer Peter Kropotkin, William Morris, the English Marxist, and some of Marx's writings, not all of it, of course. But really, this is a current that has emerged since the 1960s. In a nutshell, can you describe what eco-socialism is?
Well, I think that what you had in kind of old-school socialism, I think you had sort of people buying into the notion that you could achieve progress through growth, and and the more growth, the better. So there was a kind of agreement, I suppose, on some level between the left and the right that what you needed to do was make the pie bigger. Now, there was disagreement on how to divide that pie up. But I think now with the rise of a more ecological approach on the left, that people are no longer so interested in growing the pie. I mean, they realize that the neoliberal notion of growing the pie bigger has been replaced by the notion of is the pie tasty? Is it made from healthy ingredients? And then, of course, the pervading question of how do we divide the pie up? How do we make sure that everybody gets a big enough piece to survive? So I think there's that sort of notion within eco-socialism. I think that really the rise of climate change, particularly, and the kinds of strange weather patterns that are more and more emerging, and the possibility you're already seeing it, but even greater and greater possibilities of many, many environmental refugees, hundreds of thousands potentially of environmental refugees. This is really has changed the name of the game in terms of how our social arrangements need to be structured. And I think in Europe particularly, there has grown up this notion. Well, the French word is décroissance, and in English it's called degrowth. And there's a real attempt to kind of rethink how we can structure society so that we can live the Andean notion of my Spanish isn't very good, buena vida, to live well but not better. So this notion that we always have to be expanding and living better and having more gadgets, this I think has come under increasing suspicion by not just large portions of the left, but I think large portions of the population as a whole, who find that a certain level of dissatisfaction. I mean, there's still lots of people who love all their gadgets, but a lot of people it's just not doing it for them. So I think there's that whole pool of discontent that this sort of eco-socialism can draw on. And I think it takes different forms in different places. There's a big debate now about the commons, which is the area that's not the private sector and not the state sector, but still the air we breathe and the land and the parks and the healthcare systems and the education systems and the transit systems. I mean, they're all obviously connected to the private and the public sector, but these are things that are, in a sense, something that we all have a claim on. So there's a lot of thinking now about how this commons can be democratically run rather than be just carved up by the public and private sectors into what they call, I mean, what the World Bank loves to call private-public partnerships, which basically is bad news for everybody.
Well, what would degrowth look like in practice? Is that no growth? Growth keeping pace with population growth? What exactly would it look like?
I think the way the people in the degrowth movement talk about it, I mean, for a start, we're not talking about growth. We're not growth has many, many meanings. So you can have cultural growth, you can have personal growth. None of those kinds of growth are up for questioning, really, I think. But what we're talking about is economic growth. And I think that really what the degrowth movement is looking at is they're looking at the end of the domination of the economy. So that the economy should dictate and the needs of the economy should dictate all our decision making. So that, for example, a common theme amongst almost all politicians is to promise jobs, and jobs is the holy grail. Well, the degrowth movement is saying no, we don't need more jobs, especially if those jobs are doing ecologically destructive things, producing waste, and they aren't very satisfying to be spending 40 hours or 60 hours, or however many hours of your day that you or week that you spend doing them. So there's a real kind of rethinking of how to structure economic life and what the measure should be the measure needs to be one of much greater sustainability. The measure needs to be one of reducing our ecological footprint. A lot of environmental economists, from Herman Daly to Jean Martinez Allier from Barcelona, they'll also say, well, you know, there are places in the world that still need economic growth, and maybe sub-Saharan Africa is one of those places, and maybe parts of Asia or Bangladesh are some of those places, but that growth has to be more channeled to actually meet basic needs more than it is now, and that in our societies we might need different distribution patterns in terms of the values of how we distribute our wealth, but we don't need more overall growth. We need to sustain ourselves. We need to not just stop doing everything, but we can't just keep expanding, because it's, I mean, everybody knows that you can't have infinite growth in a finite planet. I mean, this is not rocket science. So, I mean, it's pretty, even the most rigorous right winger, when you push them to the wall, they don't have an answer for that one.
Well, though, as you said, you touched on one of the objections that might be raised, which is if one were to radically reduce growth, at this point, you have a huge wealth imbalance between the global north and the global south. And of course, you have inequality within the countries of the global north. But someone might listen to what you're saying and say, but wait a minute, I don't have a job. I need a job. How do you address those issues of economic disparity if not through the route of economic growth?
Well, I think that you'd say to that person that they definitely need income, and they definitely need their share of the society's wealth, and that if the 300 wealthiest families who control more than the 3 billion poorest people, you know, if we can't, that is a situation that's insane and obviously can't continue. But I don't think growth is the answer to, because growth has always been promised, growth in jobs. And equality's gotten worse. So it's not, you know, we have to decide to get rid of inequality. We can't decide growth will get rid of inequality, because it never has. And we'll be sitting here till doomsday waiting for it to happen. The other thing I think about degrowth is it's going to happen anyway. You know, whether it's the pressure on non-renewable resources, the way we're turning renewable resources into non-renewable resources. If you look at growth rates in the industrial economies these days, you know, it used to be after the end of the Second World War, you're talking 5, 6, 7% growth rates, and now you're talking, you know, you get 0.5% of growth rate, and the economists are jumping up and down celebrating. So it's, you know, it's, the degrowth will happen, so it's a question of how it happens. Will it happen in a planned, democratic, kind of decent way with egalitarian distribution of society's wealth and to give a decent life to people, or will it happen where the rich, you know, hide away in gate-guarded communities and it's a question of lifeboat ethics and the poorer. It's like Mad Max time. Will it be Mad Max time, or will it be some kind of decent possibility occur out of degrowth? Because degrowth is on the agenda, whether we like it or not. It's not a question of us deciding, okay, well, degrowth's a bad idea, let's not do it. It's there.
Well, of course, through the history of capitalism, one sees periods of growth and reduced growth and accelerated growth. I mean, one could make the argument that the period after World War II was the exception, not the rule. But let me just ask you about how one might be able to emphasize the positive vision that you have of degrowth rather than the negative one, that is, the democratic one. Because it seems like degrowth is a hard sell to most people who are already suffering under austerity in the wake of the economic crisis and might find the idea of degrowth not appealing when it's couched that we must all just have kind of more convivial lives. That might seem to some people, including people who don't have that much, like what little they have might be taken away. How would you respond to that sort of anxiety or concern?
Well, I think that's a real anxiety because I think that's the way growth has been working. I mean, growth has been working where we're growing, but people are doing less well. They're falling behind, and wealth is being concentrated. So I think you need to have a sort of set of proposals and a movement to back up those proposals, which call for different ways of distributing society's wealth. And that's where I think things like, I mean, the degrowth movement and also a lot of these movements in Latin America and in the southern reaches of the Mediterranean, they're calling for basic incomes, that everyone should have an income. So before, you know, coupons get clipped and profits disappear into tax havens and loopholes are found by wealthy people, that the basic income of all people gets met. So I think that's one of the underlying tenets of the degrowth movement. Now, I think that it's also about rethinking democracy, which is what we were talking about before. Because I think, I spent some time in Barcelona, in Catalonia, and there you have a sort of part of society which is marginal in the sense that I'm sure it exists in the Bay Area too, probably more so in the Bay Area because there's more of a welfare state, even in its tattered form these days in Spain. But you're having people who are recreating the economy. There's this integral Catalan cooperative movement, and they have thousands of people participating in it who have their own little communities, and it's not just a few hippies. It's like, you know, high-rise buildings with run by tenants. It's people who are brain surgeons who, you know, offer brain surgery through the cooperative. It's a kind of a sense of a commonality which we have pretty much lost in a lot of our everyone for themselves sort of dynamic that has a pretty firm grip in North America. But even in North America, you can see elements of this kind of potential for rethinking what's important. But I'm not dismissing what you're saying, because it is going to be a hard sell, because people have, you know, whether they don't have a lot or they have a lot and they want to keep it. You know, there's this famous sign in downtown Manhattan, enough is never enough. That's a logic which is built into our psyches, and it's going to be a struggle to see whether we can deal with that or not.
Well, that does it for the program. Richard, thank you so much for joining me.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with the author of SOS, Alternatives to Capitalism. His name is Richard Swift, and the book is published by New Internationalist Publications. He's a longtime journalist and activist. For 2 decades, he was the editor of the New Internationalist magazine. You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for joining us, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and Sia Song. Our intern is Ian Scullion. Our engineer is Wesley Burton. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.